Hi, this is Bill Radke, and you're listening to Weekend America's MP3 podcast, and there's nothing wrong with that. But did you know there's a way to hear all of Weekend America, plus see pictures, videos, skip forward and backward through stories with better sound quality? It's the Weekend America Enhanced Podcast. And to subscribe, search for Weekend America in iTunes or go to our website and click on Enhanced Podcast.
Coming up on Weekend America.
Presidential candidates are stumping this weekend. This Ohio couple wants to know what they'll do to bring back jobs.
I mean, we'll definitely have to cut back. We just haven't decided on what yet.
Part of it might have to be moving.
Yeah. Move to a cheaper neighborhood, but then you got higher crime. So,
I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. If you're in Ohio or Texas, you might get a late night phone call this weekend.
Hello, my name is Barack Obama, and I'd like to share a few ideas with you about my candidacy.
It's 3 a.m., you're sleeping? Shouldn't you be thinking of politics? And in San Francisco, Marie Harrison is wondering what's happening to her neighborhood.
Where are all these people going? Is everybody deciding to get out of San Francisco?
City leaders deal with an African-American exodus. We'll take you there on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend, the presidential candidates are out there trying to set themselves apart, and Weekend America is here to help. This hour, a professional marketer will tell the candidates how to make a name for themselves. What do you think is a good political slogan?
I've been using Obama Mama.
Bills for Hills.
My slogan, even though I'm not voting for Huckabee, would be I Heart Huckabee.
Law fooey.
Kind of liary barfy.
I just spend millions of dollars, let's do it.
The whole campaign to me, you know, watching it on the news, reading about this and that, I mean, it just leaves you in a state of blah. You know, I mean, the word fits perfectly. And then fooey is just all the nonsense that's going on with all these candidates.
Ridiculous or redonkulous.
So. Talking about both sides of the political spectrum here?
Yeah, both sides are just kind of redonkulous.
I like redonkulous fooey.
Yeah, I've got their first album on vinyl, as a matter of fact. Those voices came from Denver, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Boise, Los Angeles, and Anchorage, Alaska.
Well, the Democratic presidential candidates are crisscrossing Ohio and Texas this weekend. They're shoring up votes for Tuesday's string of primaries. In Ohio, the candidates are looking toward blue-collar workers to help them pull it off. Ohio has lost almost 240,000 manufacturing jobs since 2000. So, Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are taking their talking points that they hope will resonate: more jobs, economic development, and a tougher stance on free trade. From WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito profiles one family that's dealing with job loss and how that's impacting their votes.
Weekends have usually meant overtime for Ron and Audra Guy of Canton, Ohio. For much of the last decade, they both worked at the Hoover vacuum plant for $16 an hour. Overtime could boost their pay by as much as $800 a month. It allowed the guys to raise their family of six in this nice ranch house in a tree-lined suburb. They traded leisure for comfort. Now they have neither. Audrey lost her job at Hoover 3 weeks ago. Ron's last day was yesterday.
That's a big cut because you got to multiply it by two because we both work there. So, I mean, right now I'm actually working two jobs. I'm working at Hoover's right now, but I also clean banks at night.
Was for extra money, but it's not extra money now.
Yeah.
They sit on their couch in front of a big screen TV in the few hours they have together before Ron heads off to his second job. It's been a long couple of months for them, full of anticipation of this moment. And now that it's here, they've got some decisions to make.
I mean, we'll definitely have to cut back. We just haven't decided on what yet.
No, it's one of those conversations you, like, don't want.
Yeah, right. Wait till the last minute.
Oh, yeah.
Part of it might have to be moving.
Yeah. Move to a cheaper neighborhood, but then you got higher crime, so.
The guys are among 800 workers that have lost their jobs at the local Hoover plant. The layoffs have hit their neighborhood hard. For sale signs perch in snow-covered lawns on nearly every block. Foreclosures are rising. Property and income tax revenues are falling. The township keeps asking voters to raise taxes to help the schools, but time and again, voters in the Plain local school district have said no. Audra Guy says many of her neighbors have been laid off, too.
most of the people at Hoover's, most of them live in Plain Local, they'll tell you they're not going to pass that levy. So, and then we have our kids, like my son, he's in sports and he has to pay to play. I've had to pay $125 for each sport. And they're talking about even cutting that out next year if we don't pass this levy.
The guys blame poor management and free trade agreements like the 1993 North American Free Trade Act, or NAFTA. Last year, a Hong Kong-based company bought Hoover, closed the plant, and moved jobs south of the border. Backers of free trade say Americans are reaping the benefits of things like cheap vacuums, for whatever that's worth. Ironically, the guys own a Hoover vacuum cleaner made in Mexico. They say it works as good as it sounds. They keep it around partially out of loyalty to their longtime employer, and partially, it seems, because it helps them have something concrete to direct their frustrations at.
They get what they pay for.
Our company's buying stuff over in China for 32 cents an hour labor.
Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have trekked across Ohio loudly touting plans to bring back jobs, enforce trade agreements, and penalize companies that leave the Buckeye State. They want votes from people just like Ron and Audra Guy.
If there was like one thing that you would want folks outside of Ohio to understand in terms of what this election means, what would it be?
Quit letting companies take jobs out of America.
Exactly.
Put tariffs back on stuff, you know. Forget all this free trade. I want everybody to know, you know, you want to keep your jobs, you better vote on somebody who's going to stop taking jobs.
The presidential candidate's plans don't go quite that far. Dispute is focused on who has been more consistently opposed to NAFTA. In mailers and ads, the Obama campaign has reminded Ohioans that it was Bill Clinton who helped pass NAFTA in 1993. That's catching the attention of the guys. They were Clinton supporters and are now reconsidering.
You know, Obama says, you know, let's give the company that's staying a tax break, not the ones that's leaving.
But then again, they can say anything. Just doing is the problem.
Right.
That's the question.
I mean,
do you really think they're really going to?
I mean, how
much of this is lip service? You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Clinton was all against NAFTA and then ended up signing it anyways, you know. So he kind of screwed everybody, too. You know, so don't really matter who, if you get a Republican or a Democrat, if they're going to keep shipping jobs across the seas.
The guys have got a busy weekend ahead. Ron wants to start job hunting in earnest. He's hoping to head back into manufacturing and has applied for a job at a bearings manufacturer across town. The guys also have to decide how to vote on Tuesday. I'm Mari Saito for Weekend America.
As the candidates try to sell their strengths this weekend and differentiate themselves, the one disadvantage they've all got is they can't choose their own brand names. They're stuck with the names they have. If they were selling pharmaceuticals or soda or automobiles, they would be doing expensive branding research to find a saleable name like Prozac or Fruitopia or Kia Sorento. Our next guest helped come up with all of those product names and many more. Jim Singer is president and creative director of Namebase, a New York branding agency. Jim, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you to give the candidates their ideal brand names, but let's start with the names they've got. How well are they working, do you think?
I think some work better than others. I think Barack, the sound of his name is a very powerful name. In the world of phonetics, and this is strictly talking about the sounds of words, there are certain elements that cause a word to be more powerful or less powerful. His happens to be a very strong name. It starts with a plosive, which is a little explosion that you create when you say a P, a T, or a K sound. That catches the ear of the listener. So the first thing he's got going for him is he's got the puff of air, and then the Barack, which is another plosive, a very strong ending, similar to some pharmaceuticals out there, such as Prozac.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, you were part of the team that came up with the name Prozac. How does that process work?
We sit around a table and think up good-sounding words, and then we take them apart afterwards and try to sell them to the client, of course, mm-hmm. with a lot of science behind it. But we're just kind of babbling in there, and when a good one comes out, we write it down.
You just cut your commission in half with the admission that you're babbling without science.
Right.
Okay, Jim, we asked you earlier this week, so you've had a little time to think about it. If the four front-running presidential candidates were pharmaceuticals, what would you name them?
We thought that for Barack, he stands for, ostensibly, he stands for change and hope and came up with hopium. So for Barack Obama, his drug, is hopium.
Wait a second. Are you sure that that's a good idea? Especially given, doesn't he have some past recreational drug use?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and he not only doesn't deny it, he touts it.
Well, okay.
But
not that he's not a strong shot of hopamine, but I'm just wondering if that's a good idea for him.
Hopamine, that's a good one. Yeah. Good one, Phil. And then for Hillary,
yeah,
she has to constantly prove that she's tough because, you know, sometimes the assumption is that a woman might not be as tough on terrorism mm-hmm. as a man. So we thought of some names that had the morpheme, the word tough.
Tough.
Tufferell.
Nice plosive there, tough.
Yep, exactly. Tufferelle. Tufferell. Mm-hmm. Tufagra.
Okay. Okay. All right,
but so McCain now, he's not only willing to keep our troops in Iraq as long as it takes, but he'd like to even increase the mm-hmm. troop numbers. So we thought for him, his drug might be Escalatra. And then for Huckabee, we thought, well, he's an evangelical Christian. His drug might be Zelotra or Zelotine.
Are you? You're politically neutral here, right?
Of course, I'm neutral. Yeah, okay. No bias whatsoever.
No, I don't detect that. Okay. Well, Jim, that's excellent. Congratulations to you and your staff.
For this kind of naming project, we charge, you know, $50,000, $75,000 and upwards, but this is gratis.
Yeah, thanks. Consider it your pledge to public radio.
Jim Singer is president and creative director of the New York branding agency Namebase.
Well, every new product name needs a new ad campaign, and our crack web team has done some great ads. They're based on Singer's candidate names, which were based on the drug ads that we all see. Mm-hmm. I love the one that they did for Huckabee, Abraham Lincoln. It's the Rosarum ad where your dreams miss you and it says your religion misses you. They're really great. Yes. So go to our website. See if you can be sold. It's at weekendamerica.org.
And Des, I should add that just as there are pleasant sounds that make good brand names, Singer told me there are sounds he avoids. Apparently, the pew sound reminds consumers of puke and putrid.
Ugh.
Not good. And the sk sound reminds people of scummy, scurvy, and skunk. And he says you can feel your nose wrinkling when you say sk.
Ugh, I guess that's why we've never had a U.S. president name something like Scooter Pugo or something
that's
like
why.
That. You know, and I guess what makes the names work also depends on what culture you're in, too. Like a good name here in the United States could be great, but then it's repulsive in another country or vice versa.
Right. In Greece, you can get a cold can of Zit soft drink.
Oh, no.
Fine there.
Yeah,
and in Japan,
what?
Athletes will sip on Pocari Sweat, I was reading. And in London, you can get Kellogg's Cocoa Rocks, even though Cocoa Rocks is slang there for dark brown crack cocaine.
Oh, not good.
You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Your child is eating with her elbows on the table. Do you tell her to stop? And what do you say if she asks why? The questionable value of etiquette, next on Weekend America. You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Tonight, my family will observe our Saturday night tradition of sitting down and eating a homemade pizza. My one-year-old daughter will not notice where my elbows are, but my wonderful wife, Sarah, will. And Sarah would prefer that I get in the habit of keeping my elbows off the table, since that's the etiquette we'll eventually teach our child. And I feel a little differently about it. Maybe it's because I come from a big family and my parents didn't have time to explain to me that, for example, while slurping is acceptable in China, my hosts and I might feel more comfortable if I learned the American style of silent dining. Instead, I just got barked at and belittled from across the table. So maybe I'm nursing some old sensitivities here. But I also think it's more than that. Etiquette is something we pitch to our kids as being a matter of grace and consideration for others. I think this is true sometimes, but more often I think etiquette is about conforming and seeking the approval of others. And I don't think it's worth the cost most times. I'm doing a monthly series on family values. My daughter turns 13 months old this week, so these questions are far in her future. But they're important to me now. Being a parent has me thinking about which family values are and aren't worth passing on. In a moment, I'll get advice from someone who's written about the history of etiquette. But first, I spoke with my wife, Sarah, her father, Max, and the first voice you'll hear is Max's wife, Sharon.
I grew up with elbows on table, and I still do it.
I don't think I do it myself, but I don't haven't really noticed that it's much true. In others.
Okay.
There. Obviously, it's not that important to me.
Now, my wife, on the other hand.
Well, that one's not that important to me. But, you know, hopefully we'll be teaching her about being considerate of other people's, you know, feelings and rules of other people's homes when she's in those people's homes and to be thoughtful about those things.
Don't slurp. Don't chew with any volume. How are you on that rule?
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good one. Why is that intrinsically inconsiderate?
It bothers me, so I assume it would bother other people.
I've been reading about this, about where etiquette rules come from. Some people think, for example, elbows on the table, because most animals don't have elbows, and monkeys do, and gorillas do, and we want to tell ourselves that we're not like monkeys, which, of course, is the animal we are the most like. So, therefore, we're the most weirded out by that.
A lot of human existence is denying our animal nature. But I want to teach our kids what the social expectations are so that they can go into the world prepared.
I think just wearing pants should be enough to distinguish us from the monkeys.
That's a good point. What are we going to teach you about the wearing pants question? Eventually, we're going to have to confront that.
Pants are optional.
Well, that was a classic manners discussion.
This is Mark Caldwell. He wrote a book called A Short History of Rudeness about the evolution of manners. Caldwell says concerns about the decline of politeness have a lot to do with democracy and class mobility. Hundreds of years ago, the gentry and the peasants didn't do a lot of mixing. In modern egalitarian America, social groups intermingle, we combine high and low culture, we travel and meet folks who weren't raised the way we were, and all of this leads to clashes among people who have different ideas of politeness. Caldwell says these clashes seem jarring, and the so-called decline of civility gets a lot of media attention, but it's really not an emerging crisis. People have been wringing their hands about the state of manners since the Middle Ages, and the hand-wringing continues today.
Roughly every 2 or 3 years, a poll is done asking Americans, are American manners deteriorating? And the answer is always yes. And it's always yes by never less than 85% of the people responding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's curious because that's so perennial, going back, it's actually more like 600 or 700 years, I think, at this point. If that were true, if the perception were echoed in fact, then at this point we'd be all attacking ourselves with our knives and forks. We mm-hmm. wouldn't still be eating with them. We'd been using them to gouge people's eyes out.
Right.
But the evidence is that sort of somehow manners always find a level. But the problem is it's always a different level. It's always dynamic. Something that was widely regarded as rude 10 years ago. The use of language is a really classic example of that. If you simply look at broadcast commercial television over a period of 15 years, language that would have brought the nation to a halt in 1965 mm-hmm. is on every TV sitcom every night, and nobody blinks an eye at it.
So how do we react to these sliding standards? Well, some people say we should tighten our grip, put more emphasis on etiquette so that we all speak a common language of politeness. Caldwell associates this approach with the French.
A staple of French culture is that children are very early taught how to behave among adults, so that you see children constantly at restaurants in France, and they're always very, very well behaved. And I had always had the fantasy, at least in my mind, that this was because simply they were acculturated. They were taken to restaurants very early in life, and they were accommodated. In other words, they weren't instantly expected to adhere to adult standards. It's perfectly all right to color your coloring book mm-hmm. in a restaurant, for example. But then I talked to a woman who had done a book on French manners, and she said, well, no, that's not how they do it. They do it by being mean to the kids. They do it by beating them. Mm. Whether that's true or not, I don't really know, and it's a generalization. But still, a perennial debate in intellectual history about children is what are they in and of themselves? Are they nobly born human beings with completely social instincts, or are they little savages?
Yeah, you write in your book about the, I think I'm in the Jean-Jacques Rousseau camp, I learned.
Yes, in other words, and Rousseau is, of course, typically called the forefather of the idea that children are born noble, and that any bad behavior that occurs is a result of being corrupted by the world they're born into. But there's a completely opposite stream of thought, which is that they're born untamed, and they need to be instructed in the arts of civilization. And I think there's plenty of evidence for both. I don't know that anybody's ever figured out whether it's both one or neither.
Mark Caldwell is the author of A Short History of Rudeness, Manners, Morals, and Misbehavior in Modern America. What is the nature of children? I ask myself this, being a new parent. I don't think Jean-Jacques Rousseau was saying children are irresistible little angels to be indulged. In fact, he famously abandoned his kids, saying he would have been a lousy father and they were better off at the orphanage. But Rousseau also wrote about the difference between self-love and self-consciousness. Healthy self-love comes to us naturally, while self-consciousness is a social evil that depends on comparing ourselves with others. Self-consciousness, he wrote, breeds contempt, hostility, and frivolous competition. Now, that's etiquette the way I remember it. Pardon my childhood flashback. So when my wife says she wants to teach our daughter table manners so that Susanna will feel comfortable and confident in social settings, I know what she means, and I'm all for comfort and confidence. But rather than talk to my kid about etiquette, I plan to talk to her more about mindfulness, noticing how the people around her feel. And I'm hoping she can take it from there. And if not, don't worry. I promise I will keep her out of restaurants. This is Weekend America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
If you're going to San Francisco, you're probably not African American. Why Black residents are leaving the Golden Gate City, coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles, California, and it's time for a sampling of your letters. 2 weeks ago, producer Angela Kim shared a story about her mom's journey to becoming a U.S. citizen. She studied for almost 9 months and was finally sworn in at the L.A. Convention Center. Julia Davidson listens to KNOW in Minneapolis, and she pointed out that not all hopeful citizens are so lucky.
I think it's important to acknowledge all the immigrants who get lost in the process of becoming a legal citizen. There are also many immigrants who would like to become legal citizens but can't because it's too expensive or it's a cumbersome process. When people say that illegal immigrants should get in line to becoming a legal citizen, we must remind them that there is not always a line.
Last week, we brought you a story about the Art Shanties Project. For 1 month each winter, artists create a village of decorated ice fishing houses on a frozen lake just outside of Minneapolis. The story conjured up childhood memories for KPBS listener Carol Schumann of San Clemente, California.
I'm originally from Minnesota and fondly remember many communities of such ice houses on the lakes. As a child, I would skate to these little ice houses, knock on the doors, and ask the fishermen how they were doing and hoping that my reward would be a stick of Juicy Fruit gum. My Southern California friends hopefully now have a better understanding of the tough Northerners.
And finally, a correction. Last week in our weather segment, John Moe made a reference to the desert planet of Alderaan in the Star Wars galaxy, which we now know was a grave oversight.
If you're reaching for a desert planet, Alderaan should not be the first planet that you pluck to pick.
Pablo Hidalgo is the content manager for StarWars.com, and he's the co-author for the forthcoming new edition of the Star Wars Encyclopedia. So, Pablo, what is the real desert planet in the galaxy?
That would be Tatooine.
What are some other common mistakes that people make regarding Star Wars?
Usually when trying to quote the Star Wars movies, people like to say, "What movie is this from?" And then they'll say, "Luke, I am your father." Well, if you want to split hairs, that's not actually what he says. He says, "No, I am your father." But people feel compelled to put the name Luke in there so you instantly understand what movie you're talking about. Likewise, Alec Guinness, as Obi-Wan Kenobi, never says, "May the Force be with you."
What does he say?
He says, "The Force will be with you always." Other people say, "May the Force be with you" in the classic movies, but Alec Guinness doesn't actually say it.
In the end, we're really just talking about something that's fictional. It's not real. So why does it matter if we get it right?
There are people who look at this universe as a nice, comfortable place to visit, maybe live in, maybe spend an awful lot of time in, and anything that helps preserve the illusion helps. And when you break it, it's like you're harshing my particular fantasy right now, you know?
Do you speak Ewok?
Not fluently. The Star Wars languages, it's not so much like Star Trek, which has Klingon, but the languages that you hear spoken in the Star Wars movies are basically fragments meant to suggest that there was a full language behind it. But in actuality, there's no real language. It's usually other international phrases cut up and mixed around. Ewokese, for instance, is a bit of Tibetan mixed with a bunch of other languages.
Pablo, are there any other memorable songs from Star Wars aside from the Ewok song?
Jabba's band does a pop song back in the 1983 version of Return of the Jedi, which was called Laptanek, which is sort of like the Star Wars version of Let's Get Physical. But in 1997, that was replaced with a more bluesy number called Jedi Rocks. Not everyone loves it, but that's the kind of music Jabba's into, so there you go.
Well, Pablo, thank you for joining us. May the Force continue to be with you.
And with you.
Who need that? No. Alawa.
This is that song, Jedi Rocks, from Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi.
And as you're listening to it, consider that we love getting your comments and suggestions and corrections, so why don't you send them in to letters@weekendamerica.org. Or there's an easy way at our website, and that address again, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the first weekend of March, which means February is over, which means...
We are concluding the observance of our Heritage Month's observance.
Yes, Black History Month is over, too. That was Reverend Amos Brown. He's head of the San Francisco NAACP, and he presides over one of the city's oldest African-American churches, founded during the Gold Rush. So whether it's February or June, Black heritage is never too far from his mind. Last Sunday, Brown wasn't so focused on the end of Black History Month as the end of Black history, period.
You better march until Black folk get back in San Francisco. You better march until the Jazz District really belongs to us and we really got Africa Town, like there's Japan Town, like there's Chinatown, like there's the Mission, like there's the Italian Town, and the Financial District. You better march.
He's not the only one worried. So are some San Francisco city officials, as Weekend America's Chrissy Clark explains.
After Amos Brown's sermon, the whole church seems to want to shake his hand. Mostly older folks in suits, big jewel-toned hats. Reverend Brown greets them all with a big smile, but privately, he admits, when he looks out at his congregants, he gets a little sad.
Times gone by gave us audiences when the sanctuary was packed, people over in the gym, and down in youth buildings. But in the past 15 years, we haven't put down one chair for an overflow crowd.
Aging flocks, emptier pews. Brown says it's hard to watch, especially when he remembers what was, back when he first visited this church and this city as a teenager in the 1950s. Third Baptist is in a neighborhood called the Fillmore, a few blocks from downtown. In those days, Black culture flourished here. People called it the Harlem of the West.
It was the hub of the Black community, the haven for jazz, Black businesses. But back then, there were more African Americans in this city.
In fact, San Francisco's Black population rose steadily in the middle of the 20th century, but it's made a U-turn in the last 40 years. 96,000 African Americans lived here in 1970. Today, only 50,000 do. And most live in two neighborhoods, both poor, both dangerous. The Fillmore and this area near the city's old shipyards called Bayview Hunters Point.
Look at them kids across the street. Look at that. It's bad.
A blunt 16-year-old named Crystal Lowe tells me these days, neighborhoods like hers are known for their violence, not their culture.
This is it's a cool neighborhood, but it's just a lot of Black people, so it's crazy. You know, Black people don't get along when it's too many of them. Like, four of my cousins just got killed. One was 22, 18, 19, and the other one was 17.
So how did this happen? How did an affluent city known for embracing diversity become a place where the African-American community is barely hanging on? Of course, the answer is complicated. But a big part of it has to do with something demographers call the outmigration of the African-American middle class. You've heard of white flight? This is Black flight. And it's happening right now in lots of northern and west coast cities, L.A., New York, Chicago. But it's happening most dramatically in San Francisco. From the 1940s through the 1960s, San Francisco boasted a thriving Black middle class. Thousands of families had come from the South during World War II to work in the shipyards and other wartime jobs. A lot of them moved to the Fillmore. Black entrepreneurs started opening up shops, grocery stores, and nightclubs. Marie Harrison remembers it well. She lived in the Fillmore with her mom.
I knew my neighbors. I could drop my coats and clothes off at the cleaners and pick them up and pay you next week or pay you on Friday when I got paid, but I need the coat now or I need the dress. You know what I mean? It's just, my mother, if she was alive, would probably say it was like family.
Jazz clubs lined the streets. Jimbo's Bop City, Minnie's Can-Do Club, the Texas Playhouse. With homegrown talent like Etta James and visiting greats like John Coltrane and Dexter Gordon. But by the 1960s, the buildings were showing signs of wear. Pockets of crime had cropped up. the neighborhood was a perfect target for urban redevelopment.
What do you mean? You say redevelopment, you mean removal of Negroes?
That's writer James Baldwin getting a tour of the Fillmore District in the 1960s.
In effect, San Francisco is reclaiming this this property to build it up, which means Negroes have to go.
That's right.
60 square blocks in the heart of the neighborhood were razed. 13,000 people, mostly blacks, had to move out. Despite their good intentions, if city officials had purposely designed a plan to destroy a neighborhood, they could hardly have done a better job. Displaced families did get gold certificates from the city, promising them first dibs on new houses once they were built. But Marie Harrison says that didn't help her mother.
She never got a notice to come back, to even see if she wanted to come back. So my mother ended up in public housing.
Public housing across town. Many black families left the city altogether. The Harlem of the West was gone.
Come on in.
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
Thank you so much for having me over. Sorry.
Today, Marie Harrison still lives in San Francisco. She and her husband worked multiple jobs to buy a house in Bayview, the city's other historically black neighborhood. Gang violence is a problem. So she says when the tech bubble hit the city in the late 90s, and then the housing boom boomed, she watched her neighbors and some of her children start to move out.
Jeffrey, so that's 1, 2, 3.
Harrison does the math and counts 8 families, all black, who've sold houses on her street in the last 10 years. She says sometimes she just scratches her head and wonders.
Where are all these people going?
To cheaper, safer suburbs and back to the southern U.S., says Fred Blackwell. He's the current chief of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency, the same agency that displaced thousands of blacks from the Fillmore 40 years ago. He points to a new city initiative he's in charge of, called the African American Outmigration Task Force.
You've got people who are leaving at similar rates in the Latino community, in the Asian community, in the white community, but the difference is that you have a replacement population that's moving in, and that's not the case with the African American community.
Blackwell is African American himself. He says San Francisco hopes to keep blacks in the city by encouraging affordable housing and economic opportunities. But he says the city also needs to draw new black residents, and that's harder than you might think.
A lot of African American folks felt like, although San Francisco carried a reputation as a very progressive and liberal town, that somehow or another that reputation didn't translate into a feeling that, you know, African American folks were welcome with open arms in the city.
And that brings us back to the Fillmore District, or the historic Fillmore Jazz District, as it's now officially known, a government effort to remind the city of its black history and celebrate it. New restaurants and jazz clubs are opening, some black-owned, but not nearly as many as in the 50s and 60s. New condos are up for sale, and some have gone to long-ago displaced Fillmore residents who could prove they'd once had those golden certificates.
Now we're here on the street.
Pete Fitzsimmons is the head of the Fillmore Jazz Heritage Center. He grew up here, and these days it's an odd place. A few blocks south are some old housing projects where violent crime is rampant. A few blocks north is a swanky, mostly white neighborhood. In between, a jazz walk of fame runs along the sidewalk. Every half block or so, you see a pink granite paving stone carved with a name.
So we're looking at a paver right now, and it's got so-and-so lived in the Fillmore.
Oh, wow, it's hard to read.
Really hard to read on this one.
Al Smith?
Al Smith, a piano player.
The letters are tiny and almost impossible to make out.
But when you do find one and you realize and you look up and you Google the artist that's mentioned on the paver, it'll blow your mind at who some of these people were.
If you do Google the history of the Fillmore District, you'll read about how before African Americans lived here, it was mostly Japanese American. Before that, Russian Jews. And long before that, the Miwok and Ohlone tribes.
Yeah.
A city is layers of change, layers of history. San Francisco's challenge now is to find a way that the city's rich African American history isn't something you have to Google, but something that's obvious, right out there on the street. In San Francisco, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
We're glad to be with you this weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke, and we're going to bring you next our Listening In series. It's about the role that music plays in people's lives. Today we meet Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a surgeon, author, and a 2006 MacArthur Fellow. Dr. Gawande loves listening to music while he works.
Sometimes we'll have requests from patients to play music of their choice. You know, if there's some music that's soothing to somebody, we put it on or even give them their own headphones.
Nowadays, there are lots of doctors who are set up to play your music while you're waiting for an exam, while you're undergoing a procedure, even while you're falling asleep for major surgery. Now, for my operating room, I would request something from the Please Hammer, Don't Hurt 'Em album, but that's me. I want to know about you. What music would you want playing the next time you go see the doctor?
Well, the next time I'm in that waiting room, and the exam room, actually, waiting for 40 minutes, I think I'm going to go with Michael Frank's Popsicle Toes. So share your songs with us, and next week we're going to put together a playlist for you, Songs for the Doctor's Office. Go to weekendamerica.org.
For the northeastern U.S., this weekend gives you more snow. Here with a look at some more weekend weather is Brendan Noonan.
When you think spring break, you think art houses, voluntary poverty, berets, and coffeehouse poetry. At least you might when you hear something called Spring Break at Bohemia. But then you'd realize this is Mount Bohemia, Michigan. And spring break means snow showers and a $1,000 bikini contest. But wasn't it nice while it lasted? Okay, which group is tougher? At Florida's Daytona Bike Week, people are going 100 miles an hour wearing leather in 75-degree heat. But at the Skinny Tire Festival in Moab, Utah, they're pedaling 50 miles of canyons in 60-degree heat. I think I'll call the motorcyclists tougher, because frankly, pool cues hurt when they hit your face and eyes. And besides, the road bikers will probably be too tired to catch me. And there's a psychic fair and spiritual healing festival this weekend. If you're a psychic, you probably already knew that. But the rest of you are thinking tarot cards, palm readings, auras, sunny and 65 in Venice Beach, California, right? Well, for your information, it's Santa Monica. But otherwise, yeah. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
When the phone rings in the middle of the night, maybe it's not your scorned lover. It could be the next president of the United States. Coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by LendingTree, helping customers find the fixed-rate loan that's right for them. You can choose from up to four offers today, 1-800-555-TREE or at LendingTree.com. When banks compete, you win.
From American Public Media, it's great to be with you this weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This week, Senator Hillary Clinton is airing an ad that asks voters to think hard about who they'd want to have answering the White House phone at 3 a.m., but lately, it's been the other way around. Voters are complaining about getting pre-recorded phone calls from the candidates at all times of night. On Wednesday, the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration considered a bill that would ban these robocall abuses. But we asked some writers to imagine What would it sound like if the candidates intended to call you in the middle of the night?
Hi, this is Barack Obama. Sorry to call you at bedtime. I'm exhausted, too. I've been walking on water all day. Sometimes when I look out at the tens of thousands of adoring fans, mouths agape as clouds of gold billow from my honeyed lungs, I think to myself, you know what I'm missing?
Bill Johnson's.
Vote.
Bill Johnson.
You are my special friend, and I need your support. You matter to me.
Hi, I'm John McCain. If you're hearing this, then you've been identified as a conservative who doesn't think I'm conservative enough. First, I want to assure you that this call was recorded by Americans in America. You know what else is American? This whistle. Wake up, you chubby maggot, and get your butt down to the voting booth. You got a choice between me, Slim McLiberal, and Goldilocks. Now am I conservative enough for you, you little jerk?
Hi. It's Hill. Sorry to be calling so late. Not gonna lie, I'm a little drunky Brewster. What happened to us? I used to be your one and only. You said it was inevitable that we would be together. What did I do that was so bad? How can I get you back? Okay, listen. Give me a call sometime. I gotta go. I love you. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Bye.
Hello, my name is Barack Obama, and I'd like to share a few ideas with you about my candidacy. Hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Sorry, bad reception. Anyway, let's start with the economy. When I am president, the first thing I will do is lower interest rates. Now, about foreign policy. I look forward to withdrawal of the treaties with the standing in the world. Finally, in regards to health care, you can rest assured that I will and that everyone gets a pony. Now that's change you can believe in.
Hey, you up? Yeah, it's Mike Huckabee. I just think, I refuse. Is there some chance I could still stick around? I realize it's not technically campaigning, and I wouldn't want people to vote for me necessarily, or maybe if it were a vote, I would want it to be done on paper and kind of tossed into an old shoebox. Hush puppies. So what I'm driving at is, do you have an old shoebox? I know it sounds weird. Just forget it. Why am I even calling? Hey, I just wanted to know if you saw me on SNL. Compare that performance to my cheesehead joke during my concession speech. Press 1 if you loved it. Okay, night-night.
Main menu. If you are an independent, press 1. If you are a conservative, press 2.
Hi, this is Maverick John McCain. For years, I've been building bridges in the Senate and forging bipartisan solutions to the problems that face America. I've never been afraid to take an unpopular position, even in defiance of my own party. So if you value free thinking and open-mindedness, vote John McCain.
Main menu. If you are an independent...
Hi, this is stalwart Republican John McCain. For years, I've been unwavering in my adherence to fundamental conservative principles.
Ron Paul here, and I gotta be quick because the government's probably tapped this phone. Sorry to wake you up. Were you dreaming of drugs and abortions? If I'm president, you won't have to dream. Do you like taxes? What are you, stoned? If you are, that's fine by me, but taxes? Shut up! Ron Paul for president. Do you hear black helicopters? I gotta go.
I'm Hillary Rodham Clinton, and I approve this message.
This is 1-800-COLLECT with a collect call from...
Ralph Nader.
To accept charges, press 1 now. To deny charges, press 2.
Our phone calls were written by Matthew Baldwin, Rico Galliano, Brendan Newnham, and Jeff Johnson. We should add that the North Carolina State Attorney General this week has asked all the candidates to voluntarily comply with the Do Not Call Registry. Now, that's the tool that Congress created that lets you block telemarketers. It doesn't apply to campaign calls, but some people think it should. Now, politicians would quibble with that because they rely on those phone solicitation calls for their polling information, for turning out the vote. And plus, they argue that what they have is actually political speech, and by law, that deserves more protection than commercial speech.
And speaking of political speech, Des, you mentioned the new Clinton ad asking who you want in the White House answering the emergency 3 a.m. phone call while your kids are asleep looking cute and very vulnerable. The ad doesn't mention Obama, but it implies that she's battle-tested and he's not.
Yeah, and Obama accused Clinton of using scare tactics with that ad, but now his campaign is airing an ad that uses the same video of sleeping children, but then it tells you that he's the one that you'd want to have answering that phone call.
And the phone wars continue with perhaps the Tuesday primaries being a wake-up call. We'll see. You're listening to Weekend America. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. We close this hour not before reminding you that spring is almost here, just 19 days away. And we'd like to hear what spring means to you. Maybe it's baseball, or planting a crop, heading out for spring break. Whatever it is, share with us a story that's meaningful to you about spring. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. And remember, you can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
Financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
What do these two songs have in common?
In a time for a rubber band. Does that make me crazy? Does that make me crazy?
On the next Weekend America, one doctor thinks these songs are perfect for opening you up and putting you back together again.